Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, episode 36. Winning's easy, governing's harder. In the smash hit Broadway musical Hamilton, George Washington says to Alexander Hamilton, "Winning was easy, young man, governing's harder." The PAP won the 1959 general election. Now they were about to learn the wisdom of George Washington. After they won the general election in 1959, the PAP leaders hit the ground running. No, sprinting. In the governor's speech, they declared that they would be a revolutionary government. They would rise up and create a true socialist state. They spent the first year legislating like they were running out of time, legislating like it was going out of style, legislating like tomorrow wouldn't arrive, legislating like they needed it to survive. And this would lead to severe tensions within the government and within the party. Many members, many people in the party, many people who were very, very smart and well-educated and well-informed said, "Hey, slow down. Such important issues cannot be resolved overnight. You can't simply throw up legislation. You need research. You need consultation. You need time to think things through carefully. Singapore is not so fragile, not in so much danger, not in such imminent need that we cannot wait a little while more. Singapore is stable, peaceful, prosperous. What is the rush?" But no. The PAP leadership acted like they were running out of time, like they were conscious that they had only so much time to get things done, that if they didn't get it done now, they might never get the opportunity later. They were men in a hurry. And they needed to control everything quickly, which is, I think, more to the point. Lee Kuan Yew needed to control everything and control everything quickly. Delay was unacceptable. Compromise was unacceptable. Because, for one, he always assumed he was the smartest in the room. He was inimitable and original. He didn't hesitate, exhibited no restraint. For another, he probably believed that the control he wanted would make the implementation of his legislation easier. It would make the socialist revolution easier. In that sense, he was no different from the tyrants of Russia or China. But most of all, I think Lee had been in a situation where he had been at mercy to a popular vote back in 1958 within the party. And he won that vote, but he hadn't won enough. He hadn't won everything. He hadn't won complete control. And he wasn't going to let that happen again. So the first year, the PAP focused on two things. The first was a rush, was pushing through reams and reams of legislation, affecting the state in all sorts of ways, some of which we are still only just coming to grips with today. And the second was consolidating control under the cabinet, and more specifically under Lee Kuan Yew, so that he would never be at anyone's mercy ever again. And so even before the PAP took office, Lee Kuan Yew was already plotting and scheming. The PAP had to keep its campaign promise of releasing political detainees, all political detainees. Lee Kuan Yew had spent the past few years publicly criticizing the government for detaining the left-wing PAP leadership, while privately supporting the government's detention because it removed his political rivals from within the PAP, giving him unchallenged control of the party. So having to release them was not something he looked forward to. And so he came up with a rather legalistic and political plan. You'll find that all of Lee's plans are rather legalistic and political. That was his hallmark. So he came up with this plan to enable him to control the detainees after they were released. Before the election on 30th May, Lee went and met with British Governor William Goode on the 14th of May to explain his plan. To Goode's astonishment, Lee asked him to delay introducing self-government to Singapore. Why on earth, after fighting so hard for self-government, would you want a delay? Well, Li asked him to wait before introducing the new constitution and swearing in the new government because Li needed time to get Lim Chin Siong, Devan Nair, Fong Swee Suan, S. Budhal, James Puthucheary and Chan Chiao To to sign an undertaking of loyalty to the PAP doctrine. Li argued that this would give the public the impression that Li had been right all along and allow Li to attack Lim Chin Siong for any deviation from the PAP party line. And since Li controlled the PAP party line, it would be a deviation from what Li wanted, from Li's wishes. But the signing had to happen now. If the signing happened after he was in power, said Li, quote, Lim would then be signing because Li had the gun in his hand, unquote. And furthermore, quote, psychologically, it was all important that the release of their six close colleagues should be a condition precedent to the PAP taking office, unquote. This was, quote, all important in the minds of the Chinese-speaking mass whose wholehearted support was all important to Lee Kuan Yew, unquote. William Goode belittled Li. He mocked Li's obsession with appearances, but Li refused to budge. He reassured William Goode that his intention was only to release the six and that, quote, he had no intention of releasing any others, unquote. He promised to also brief Abdul Razak, the Federation of Malaya representative in Singapore's Internal Security Council, to ensure no opposition from the Federation. Despite Goode's misgivings, he eventually agreed. Of course, what Li did not anticipate was that over the next 2 years, he would be the one attacked for deviating from the PAP party line. And this is part of the fundamental conflict within the PAP. Li, as a lawyer, argued on the letter of the law, the interpretation of the letter of the law. But the leaders of the PAP left had no patience for that. As trade unionists, they were all too experienced with the colonial government using and manipulating the letter of the law against them. Instead, they cared more, they argued more about the spirit of the law and more generally, the principles at stake. Principles like accountability, responsibility, freedom and liberty. In the meantime, before the release of the six, to further cement Li's leadership, the PAP moved up the elections for its Central Executive Committee to 31st May 1959. Note the date, just before the six were released from prison. So they moved it up to 31st May to ensure that formerly detained PAP members could not stand for election after they were released. The term of the CEC was changed to 2 years to give the CEC greater breathing space. The former detainees eventually released would be denied cadre membership, and those who were not citizens were denied citizenship. And so, with everything fixed, the detainees would now be released. Oh, but wait. Not all of them. No, only six to begin with. Remember, Li had told William Goode that his intention was to release six and only six. But publicly, he promised that all detainees would be released within 3 to 6 months. And after an initial burst of releases, detainees were released in progressively smaller and smaller and smaller batches at progressively larger and larger and larger intervals. By early 1960, less than a year after the PAP took office, releases had come to a complete halt. Later, Lee Kuan Yew would rely on legalistic sophistry. He would point out that his words were vague. They could be interpreted to mean that he only promised to release detainees who had been PAP members, and so he had fulfilled that pledge. But of course, again, the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. Li clearly intended for his words to be interpreted by the public as that he would release all detainees. But of course, he carefully worded it so that he was only committed to releasing a certain subset of the detainees, PAP members. But in the minds of the public and of the PAP membership, he had made a promise to release all detainees, and he was not keeping it. We'll come back to this next week. So after all that, finally, on the 4th of June 1959, to a rapturous welcome, the first six detainees were released from jail. Little did they know the effort Li had already gone to neutralize and undermine his erstwhile colleagues. and it was under such pretenses that the PAP time in office started. In retrospect, given how much effort Lee put into fixing his rivals, it's hardly a surprise that the party would end up splitting into three from its internal tensions. But now that the detainees were released, the PAP had to get down to governing. And the PAP spent its first year in office fulfilling many of its campaign promises, plucking the low-hanging fruit. Mindful of the Chinese-speaking voters who had ushered it into office, throughout its first year, the PAP introduced a steady stream of legislation aimed at addressing their concerns. The PAP declared in their first policy speech their determination to overturn the colonial order and form a, quote-unquote, egalitarian society via social, cultural, and political and economic revolution. Armed with its electoral mandate and an overwhelming majority in the Legislative Assembly, everything initially went well. The HDB announced plans to build over 52,000 units over the next 5 years. The civil service was scrutinized for inefficiencies, corruption, and discriminatory practices. Rural residents, including farmers who had been forcibly relocated by the colonial government, were finally awarded the titles to their land after years of empty promises. After the first 6 months, the PAP drew praise for their, quote-unquote, considerable achievements and, quote, reforms winning the confidence of the people, unquote. In education in particular, it was initially very successful. New education begins, the new Minister for Education and former Malayan Democratic Union executive Yong Nak Lin declared in the first sitting of the Assembly. He swiftly imposed new policies based on the 1956 All-Party Report, including a uniform syllabus, equality of treatment for the four language streams, Malay as the national language, and an emphasis on practical subjects to meet the needs of industrialization. Education took up a quarter of the budget, the largest single item by far. New schools were built, quote, with a zeal rarely seen in past governments, unquote. These swift and decisive actions drew wide praise, especially, of course, from the Chinese press. Most of all, attention was showered on Nanta. Yong announced that the government would support Nanta on the same financial basis as University of Malaya. A government Nanta liaison committee was formed, and the government was careful to appoint Chinese-educated officials as its representatives. Nanta degrees were recognized. Lee Kuan Yew announced that the civil service would hire 70 out of Nanta's first 400 graduates and emphasized Nanta's role as a Malayan university and its importance for the creation of a Malayan culture. Scholarships were awarded to Nanta graduates for further studies in the USA. And all this was greeted with joy. The Nanyang Xiangpao declared almost tearfully, "It can be said that the wishes of the people for the well-being of Nanta have now been fulfilled after 4 years of hard struggle." Unquote. Meanwhile, with the election of a labour-friendly government, trade unions asserted themselves once again. 58 strikes broke out in the PAP government's first year, the most in any 12-month period since 1955. But without a hostile police, without a hostile government, none turned violent, and most were resolved quickly and amicably. Some notorious long-standing disputes, such as the Federation of City Council Labour Unions dispute, which had endured since 1954, were finally settled. The Hsinchu Jitpo called 1959, quote, "a year of tranquility as regards to labour-capital relations," unquote, while the Nanyang Changpao remarked that, quote, "since the setting up of self-government, there has been industrial peace," unquote. May Day 1960 was declared a public holiday. An industrial relations bill established a permanent industrial arbitration court to settle labour disputes. The Chinese press heralded a new era in industrial relations. At government request, Australian Ministry of Labour representatives visited and made recommendations for reforming trade union legislation. Their recommendations were accepted, resulting in a new trades union bill being passed in May 1960. This allowed the government to cancel smaller unions and merge larger ones, consolidating the trade union movement into a single large federation under the Singapore Trades Unions Congress. G. Kandasamy won re-election as Secretary General and appointed to the STUC Secretariat many of the left-wing trade unionists, including Lim Chin Siong, Fong Swee Son, C.V. Devanaya, S. Woodhull, S.T. Barney, Dominic Puthucheary, and Jamit Singh, who were given responsibility for reorganizing the trade union movement. So this quote-unquote new phase in Singapore's history was given wholehearted support by the public, who reveled in Singapore's new status as a self-governing state. The smoothness of the first 6 months of self-government, declared the Nanyang Shangbao, showed true democracy at work, proving all the doubters and fear-mongers wrong. And the Sin Chew Jitpo echoed that, quote, Singapore was enjoying conditions which rank among the best of democratic countries in the world, unquote. They celebrated a new epoch filled with development and peace and stability, prosperity, happiness and progress, heralding the development of a united Malayan consciousness leading to communal harmony and development. And the Chinese press urged Singaporeans to study Malay and to actively participate in political and economic and social activities to create a Malayan state. But there was also a dark side to many of these reforms. The PAP leadership also spent much of the first year using these reforms to consolidate control of the government. And in particular, they sought to neutralize their allies in the anti-colonial movement by replacing their institutional bases with government-controlled alternative and marginalizing the left-wing leaders within government. And we'll talk about this when we return. The PAP government spent much of its first year from 1959 introducing reforms, especially to labour and education policy. But they also used these reforms to consolidate their control of government, of power. And in particular, they sought to neutralise their allies in the anti-colonial movement by replacing their institutional bases with government-controlled alternatives and marginalising the left-wing leaders within government. So the much-celebrated Trades Unions Bill, for example, concentrated immense power in the hands of the government, causing disquiet among trade unionists. The government dissolved the city council and transferred all its powers to the national government. It also made the Preservation of Public Security Ordinances Appeal Tribunal into a non-binding advisory committee. The PPSO is the law that permits detention without trial. And now the Appeal Tribunal was a non-binding advisory committee. You couldn't appeal the PPSO's detention orders anymore. And it further amended the PPSO to enable the government to unilaterally impose movement restrictions on anyone, even people with no prior convictions. The independence of the Corrupt Practices Investigation Bureau was ended and it was placed under the control of the Minister for Home Affairs. Plans were announced to reorganize the Singapore Harbour Board into the Port of Singapore Authority under complete government control. And these actions and more sets up the basic structure that we have today in Singapore, where power is consolidated under the cabinet, with most of it under the Prime Minister, with no independent bodies that can serve as a check or balance or exercise oversight over the Prime Minister and the cabinet. Furthermore, Lee Kuan Yew needed to replace the left's grassroots organizations with organizations that he could control. To do so, Lee planned what he called a People's Association throughout Singapore, which would serve to keep the government fully in touch with public opinion and would also serve to explain the government's actions to the people. Publicly, of course, he talked about the public need for such an organization, but privately to the British, he was very clear it was for political purposes. This People's Association aimed to duplicate the function of the PAP left wing's educational and cultural associations, which the PAP had relied upon. The risk for him was that as he was using the government to build a grassroots organization, If the PAP lost power, it would lose access to its grassroots as well. But Lee was confident. He did not plan to lose power. The Prime Minister chaired the new People's Association. It took over management of community centres, which provided public services, and took over youth clubs. These provided another way to reach out to the people and earn their loyalty. The number of community centres was increased rapidly from 28 in 1959 to 103 by 1963. These centres ran leadership training courses meant to create a new generation of grassroots leaders loyal to the government, loyal to the PAP. The Works Brigade was another new creation. It was analogous to the trades unions and student societies. Its function was to put unemployed youths to work. Eventually numbering 5,000, it was also anticipated that the brigade could be used for breaking strikes. It was also welcomed as an excellent cheap solution for unemployment, and it was immediately set to tackling Singapore's notorious flooding problem. This blurring of the party and the government was, of course, morally dubious. The People's Association and Works Brigade were created to keep the PAP in power using public funds, public resources. Singapore's democracy was officially barely a year old, and already it was being undermined by a rather paranoid, arrogant government which was unable to cope with disagreement and dissent. So instead of seeking to accommodate those who had differences with it, to debate, to discuss, it sought to systematically remove opportunities for disagreement to be expressed and opportunities for support to coalesce around the disagreement. This cementing of power and decline of democracy in general was also accompanied by a decline of democracy within the government and even within the cabinet. Decision-making was concentrated in the hands of a trusted inner cabinet who felt no compunction at seeking advice from elsewhere. The inner circle of Lee Kuan Yew, Toh Chin Chye, Goh Keng Swee, S. Rajaratnam and Ong Pang Boon would be permanent fixtures in the cabinet for the next 20 years. This enabled fast, efficient decision-making and administration, but also meant decisions were imposed with a lack of consultation and external perspective. For example, massive pay cuts on the public sector and civil service saved money, but caused great discontent and left some civil servants unable to service their mortgages. Large raises on property valuations punished the lower middle class, which relied on property as the only form of social insurance. Fears were raised that the PAP was trying to drive all people into government-subsidized housing. The Women's Charter required all marriages to be registered, but the cost of registration, $14 including stamp duty, was prohibitively expensive. That was 15% of the average monthly salary back then. The legislation also had a number of loopholes and inconsistencies, including inadvertently legalizing concubines and a lack of legal protection for wives married through traditional ceremonies. While these were not major mistakes, they could be fixed, the PAP established a pattern of making decisions in haste and regretting them at leisure. In the first year alone, it used certificates of urgency to force three readings of a bill on the same day, 21 times, 21 times in the first year alone. And this included to dissolve the city council, increase its control of public finances, introduce a new film censorship system, amend the PPSO and the Criminal Law Temporary Provisions Act, pass the Industrial Relations Act, and pass the People's Association Act. All this legislation was passed with great speed, but also a minimum of scrutiny and research needed for important legislation that would radically alter the lives of Singapore citizens. By contrast, the previous Labour Front government had used the certificates of urgency only 24 times in 5 years, and nearly always to amend a defect in a law rather than introduce new groundbreaking legislation. As part of its educational reforms, the government also decided to convert Chinese schools from a 6-year secondary program to 4 years, bringing them in line with English schools as a precursor to creating a single unified educational system. While the Chinese community supported the decision in principle, the implementation was badly botched. It was basically imposed on very short notice, and there was tremendous unhappiness in the Chinese community. And meanwhile, the PAP's much trumpeted, much vaunted labour policy suddenly collapsed. Throughout its first year, the PAP leadership supported efforts by the party's officials, led by Lim Chin Siong, to reform the labour movement. The PAP leadership then realised that they had consolidated the trade union movement and then put it all in the hands of left-wing leaders, thus offering the opportunity for the creation of a rival political power base. Now, there was no indication that this was what was actually happening, for given all we know, the left-wing leaders were loyal. There's no indication that an alternative power base was forming or even being considered. But the PAP leadership was paranoid and did not want the opportunity to be available. And so, in May 1960, after the bill, the trades union bill had already passed, the government abruptly withdrew registrations for all trade union federations and told Yusof Ishak, the Yang Dipertuan Negara, to withhold assent to the trades union bill becoming law. This decision caused huge anger among the PAP rank and file, who had put so much effort into the reorganizations. It was Lim Chin Siong who restrained them and urged them to be calm. And the government subsequently reorganized the Singapore Trades Union Congress and the leadership that it could control. Discontent within the PAP multiplied, especially among those who had done so much to help the party win power but were now marginalized. James Puthucheary and S. Woodhull were among those who wrote open letters in the PAP newsletter, Petir, urging the government to moderate its stance and open itself to criticism. Woodhull described the, quote, tough talk, arrogance, and downright cockiness of some of our party officials, unquote. While their decisions were generally correct, he wrote, quote, short-shriftedness and a complete lack of explanation and persuasion, unquote, revealed a lack of confidence in the party's capacity to, quote, evoke the right responses to reason and truth, unquote. Looking back years and years later, To Chin Chai admitted, yes, the critics were right. But at the time, he and the rest of the PAP leadership showed no desire to listen. S. Rajaratnam gave a speech calling their critics opportunists and turncoats, upset by the rapid changes introduced by the government. Lee Kuan Yew's open reply to Puthucheary and Woodhull warned against the, quote, lunatic fringe of the party, unquote, with their own personal political ambitions, who use smear and intimidation in pursuit of their aims. And he wrote, and this is totally true, he wrote that cream rises to the top, but bits of scum now and again also come up to the top. And he said that the party would deal firmly with them. British officials were also disappointed by the PAP leadership's character. They appreciated the PAP's difficulties and its firm stand against communism. However, they also described tendencies to party dictatorship that hampered effective governance. Ministers who were, quote, impatient of criticism, writing sickeningly smug memoranda, taking actions which smacked of authoritarianism, and a government who feel they know all the answers themselves and do not welcome suggestions, unquote. Lord Selkirk, who was British Commissioner from 1959 to 1963, he succeeded William Goode at the end of 1959, summarised, quote, what had been noted as self-confidence before the PAP took power soon became touched with arrogance. Their energy became aggressive, and their party loyalty marked with extreme intolerance of any opposition or criticism. Their discipline was characterised by bullying, unquote. And it was Lee Kuan Yew, the undisputed leader of the PAP, who epitomized their frustration. He was arrogant and temperamental. Not an easy man to get on with, wrote Selkirk. Selkirk doubted his conviction, his toughness. And Lee appeared to believe control and power could substitute for persuasion and consensus. Selkirk mused, quote, "The only subject which I have ever heard Lee Kuan Yew talk about with any sense of feeling is the subject of power. Political power is, I believe, almost an obsession to him." Likewise, Deputy Commissioner Philip Moore noted that, quote, "Power means everything to him," that's Lee Kuan Yew, "and to retain it, he may be prepared to resort to desperate measures." Moore urged Lee and Goh Keng Swee to be, quote, "less dictatorial and arrogant in the attitudes and give a more humane and understanding leadership to Singapore," unquote. But there was no alternative to Lee Kuan Yew. "For all his faults," said Commissioner Selkirk, "Lee was, quote, head and shoulders ahead of his colleagues in the government, most of whom, with the exception of Goh Keng Swee, are pretty poor stuff. Goh was the most level-headed and least doctrinaire of the Singapore ministers, though, unfortunately, he is too easygoing to play a really dominant part in political affairs," unquote. The British and the Federation of Malaya quickly learnt that Lee always had the final word in Singapore. Several times, Lee openly overruled his cabinet, and he kept everyone but Goh Keng Swee in the dark as to his plans. Why did Lee have to behave this way? Lee knew he had to know that he upset people who worked with him. He had to know that these people got frustrated and angry over his arrogance. Did he interpret that as their failing? Did he see the anger of people as their own fault? Was he so blind and arrogant that he expected the world to work for him? Or was he self-aware enough to understand that it was his fault, but was so utterly self-confident that he accepted the situation anyway? He blamed people for not agreeing with him, blamed them for not being smart enough to see his position, understand him, and remained so convinced that he refused to compromise to the point where, over the next 2 years, it nearly destroyed him. Over the next few months, as we detailed the crucial episodes in the decolonization of Singapore, and especially as we watched Lee Kuan Yew nearly destroy himself in his quest for power, this is a question, I think, that's worth keeping in the back of your mind. Did Lee Kuan Yew know what he was doing? So, to conclude today, by the end of the first year, the honeymoon was over for the PAP government. The low-hanging fruit had been plucked. The obvious gains had been made. The road forward would be far more uncertain and would need much more careful planning and thought. But instead, the PAP leadership was embarking on changes that would have far-reaching consequences, and they did so at breakneck speed. And they were making lots of avoidable mistakes. This would have been the time to bring in different perspectives, different ideas, greater scrutiny, greater discussion, greater consensus. But rather than doing so, they were doing the opposite. They were consolidating power in their hands, removing the ability of people outside of the inner cabinet to contribute, to make constructive criticism, or simply to be consulted on plans and policies. Anger was building within the PAP and even within the cabinet over the lack of responsibility and transparency, accountability, and the harsh and uncompromising language of the PAP inner cabinet to those who tried to proffer nothing more than constructive criticism. A break was coming, and the issue on which the break would occur was the most starkly emblematic of colonialism. It was the issue of justice. Specifically, justice for political detainees. Nothing epitomized the state of colonialism more than the ability of a government to take away the lives of its citizens without trial. Singapore was supposed to be internally self-governing, to be on its way to becoming a socialist democracy, to have a genuine anti-colonial left-wing party in power. A democracy gives people the right to trial in open court. But the PAP weren't giving people this. They were keeping political detainees behind bars without trial. And so the PAP leadership was proving themselves to be tyrants, to be colonialists, to be imperialists, to be hypocrites, and most of all, to be traitors to the people of Singapore. Join us next week when we talk about this. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.